Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, your destination for all things lacrosse. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, Jack Piatelli. Jack, this shirt, I need it. This is incredible. What? Who is now doing your designs? Because it's very good. Very improved.
Chris Widello.
Really?
Designed this logo.
Big Widello.
Yes.
I got good stories about him.
Yes. He's very talented.
He is.
And he's a good coach. And very talented off the field as well. So, yeah, he did a great job designing our... This is our indoor box logo.
Yes, that's why I like it. It
looks Stallion. Great.
It's incredible.
Italian Stallion.
Gotta get... It's like playing bingo with you every time we intro a show. It's like, it's going to be something Italian, something about the club team, something about Springfield. One of those three things is going to happen. And I made the Springfield thing just happen.
And the only thing with you is it's about Clark.
That's true. I wore it today on purpose. Today. I did do it on purpose today, but I do want to intro our guest, John Yeager. How are we doing?
Great, Kyle. How are you?
Hey, Jack.
Hi, Johnny. Thanks for joining us, John. It's been a while since we connected and we had a chance to talk on the phone, about a month ago, and really excited to get your book in the mail as the Coaching Zone. It's been really inspirational for me to read it and learn so much about your philosophy on coaching, and there's a lot of great quotes in there. My question is, what got you to write the book, and how long of a time did it take you to write this book?
Well, Jack, I think I took the feast of coaches that I grew up around, that I had, and that I've known and met and hearing from other athletes about their coaches, and I kind of put a compilation of it all together over time. And because for a while, there's a lot of standard coaching education programs and books out there. And I felt we needed to go kind of the next step with that. And so that's when I thought about doing that. And almost instead of where many times, you know, that you take locker room to the boardroom and right. Different types of situations with terminology, in many ways, this is the boardroom to the locker room, because I take a lot of tried and true corporate and other types of business strategies and kind of tune them towards athletics and sports and in coaching. Because being a good leader, whether you're an athletic coach or a business coach or a business leader, you're coaching at those times. So what I wanted to do in many ways is to get coaches who are in a growth mindset, kind of reflect on their own coaching through their experience, in some ways get them a little bit healthfully confused, to kind of come back to some greater understanding so they can grow as coaches. So that was kind of the evolution of this. And I'd been in many ways in my own head working on this for many, many years, and still I started putting pen to paper maybe around 5 years ago. And it got going, and I finally kind of a little slowdown, and then finally COVID hit. And when COVID hit, a lot of some of my consulting kind of dried up, or most of it was with coaches, was in teams, was through virtual media. That's where I really put the final push into the book. And so it finally came out in 2021.
What I love about the book, John, you talk about evaluation. So many coaches coach and they're evaluating their players all the time, but you need to take that time to evaluate yourself as a coach and, you know, how effective you are. How passionate, you talk about passion, you talk about purpose. You want to expand on that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the idea is that passion and purpose are kind of, they seem opposites, but they need to live together. And how can coaches, no matter where they are in their coaching journey, that they can go back and reflect on that? And I'm really looking for coaches who have really what we've heard people say is a conscious competence. Okay, that they want to be able to grow. They know their strengths and they also know their blind spots. And then how can they look at those blind spots and actually grow from there to be better coaches over time? Okay, instead of just staying stale and where they are right now. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I rolled in the studio today and I'm tired. I'm like, haven't gotten any sleep. I've had a couple rough games with the boys recently. And Jack, ever great. You look terrible, man. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a little emotionally drained from coaching. So I think one of the things that I got back into coaching after a long break,
I coach a JV and I'm an assistant varsity coach at a very small school in New Hampshire. And the difference between, this is my third season, the difference between the first season, second season, third season is so disparate. It's like, especially from last year to this year, I've just had trouble emotionally regulating. And I think like something like this would like, I feel like it would definitely help me. Do you find that there are coaches on an emotional spectrum that you deal with a lot? Like, is that a big part of what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think I think where coaches are, what's the sweet spot of that emotional spectrum? Okay, one of the things I mentioned in my book is the work that kind of a mental skills consultant, Adam Naylor, does. He's South Shore in Boston. And basically he talked about a hockey coach once who really got emotional, especially when he felt that his players were in danger and the refs weren't making the good calls. So if you picture a coach getting upset with an official, taking their foot and putting on the front of the bench boards there and coming over like that, because that's the core values of a coach are actually, man, that really hits me at home where players are not taken care of. And so basically, Adam had this coach not to change his emotions, because that's hard to do, because there's a lot of benefit in those emotions too.
Right.
But times when he was doing that a little bit too much, and the AD of the school is finally saying, hey, I think your players think you're a little bit nuts, so you better calm it down and not get these bench minors. And so instead of saying, when you feel that those emotions are coming on and you feel that urge, instead of going forward, take a step back into the back of the glass. And when you do that, then come forward. And guess what happens? You don't come as far forward. Okay. And it settles the thing in there. So it's not necessarily taking away the emotion, because I think there's incredible value add to that. It's knowing that, but it's also knowing that where is your, what I call the two coaching voices. And basically we have what we call automatic or system one thinking and reflective or system two thinking. And this is based on a lot of the work that psychologist John Hay has done, but also in a great book by Daniel Kahneman from Princeton called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And the thing is, when we think fast, and that happens a lot in our coaching, it happens with our athletes. We want them to think fast. They don't have a lot of time to sit back, think about, well, should I pass the ball right now? No, you got to do it. And the same thing with coaches. You can take a little bit more reflective time in practice, but when you're in a game, it's automatic. It's coming out there. So basically, if coaches want to change how they come out across automatically in a game situation, they can actually slow down and practice that during practices in some way, and actually outside of the practice environment, and say, okay, when this situation happens where I tend to get a little bit more emotive, I had to press the pause button right here, okay, and slow it down, okay? And when you do that, it allows you to regulate your emotions a little bit more. But also, it's not a fair fight. There's a term called halts. And halts is basically when you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or stressed out, it's a lot more difficult to regulate emotions. Okay?
That was Kyle when he walked into the studio today.
We had a real moment before we started recording. Yeah, it's funny because I had this argument with someone once where they're like, well, how do you your coaching is very like visceral. You're very, as you said, using one of your terms, emotive. I'm always there. You always know where I am. And one of the things that comes with that is like people can see that as angry or too active or something like that. And I had someone say, like, one time I pulled my players off the field and they were like, what are you doing? Like, you can't do that. I was like, it's not your job to do that. I was like, you're right. My job is to keep them safe. And I don't think that they feel safe right now. And I don't feel safe with them out there. So like, that's my first job. And ever since I like said that, that's kind of clicked into place for me as like, my job is, yes, I have to teach you this game. I'm coaching JV primarily, so I'm not teaching you necessarily to win. It's not about winning. It's about playing the game the right way. playing in the system, playing with the right culture, not being out of control, being in control of everything that you do. So I look at it that way, but I think that it doesn't look that way. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And it, because it depends on how other coaches view that, because if some coaches view the over-emotion out there, that they may not value that. It may press a button for them. But I think what you had mentioned, something that you want your athletes to stay, your players to be safe. And the question that I ask you then, Kyle, is do they feel that when they're in with you, that they're in a safe space?
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing, is that they feel, being emotive, they know you. There's a level of what we call vulnerability trust that's going on. So they know you. Okay, and they know you care and love them and make them feel that they belong. You listen to them, you take them seriously, you get them to feel that they're genuinely needed. So they know when you're emotive, they know that you're caring about them.
Right.
Okay. And so that allows for that to happen. So that coach that you're coaching allows for them to be in a safe space, for them to produce, to be their best selves. So when they go out there, there's not a nanosecond of doubt about when coach responds to me or somebody else, that the bottom line is that he cares for me and my well-being.
Right. And the best interest is always kind of at hand, right? I think especially when you're coaching at a developmental level, as opposed to a performance level, I think that's a different kind of coaching. And I think that it can exist in the same person, it can exist in the same space, but I think that's, I constantly, just talking as a coach, man, I'm sorry you're my therapist right now, but like I constantly battle with that, to have performance versus teaching moments, and how do you get one from the other, and does one just automatically beget the other, or like how does that work? And it's different for every kid, you know,
right? Yeah. And it's almost like this, once again, it's not an either or there. It's a both and, it's a polarity. And basically one of the strong polarities I use when I work coaches is get the job done, which is important. You want to get the job done. Okay. But also you want the second part of that, you want to empower athletes and players. Okay. So how do you hit the sweet spot of that? You want to get the job done and then you want to empower them. Okay. It's interesting. Right now I'm sitting in an office at a major corporation that's looking at how they can empower their employees and at the same time making sure the job gets done. Okay. And that it goes right into sports. Okay.
Yeah.
Into coaching. So it's hitting the sweet spot there. So if you're working developmentally, you're providing direction, but you're also empowering them. So you get the job done, you build relationships, you provide direction, you empower. And it's getting to that level, as I say, that sweet spot back and forth. Now, that takes effort by the coach. And some coaches are not willing to do that if they have some issues with that, because they don't realize maybe they have an issue with that. Or it can kind of get lazy. And not worry about that. Hey, this is my way. This is what I do. The players have to adjust to me. That's the bottom line. Okay. And that works in some cases, but it doesn't always work. And so when it doesn't work, how can coaches become more aware of that, conscious of that, so that they can say, well, maybe I got to push more on this polarity right now. Bottom line, do my players feel safe? Okay.
Yeah.
John, part two of your book, you talked about empowering, leading and empowering. So talk about getting the job done and empowering the individuals to get the job done. Can they get the job done without being empowered?
Sometimes they can get the job done, but if they're not empowered and have ownership for what they do, their satisfaction and enjoyment in the game suffers.
Yeah.
You can have an incredibly talented person who can get the job done no matter what. 3 goals, 2 assists, no matter what. Okay. But the bottom line is that, yeah, they feel empowered. Do they have their ownership? Do they own what they do? And that gets us to another polarity, individual and team, that they feel competent as an individual, but also a major part of that there too. So yes, I mean, I think the answer is that you, to be empowered, belies that you bring in satisfaction and enjoyment in relationship to the performance that you have. Because we're human beings, we're fragile, okay? And we make mistakes, okay? And so it changes. It's just like every time a coach or an athlete steps over the line onto the playing field, there's a risk you take, and you're not sure how that performance is totally going to go. That's kind of the joy of sports, and that's why it's kind of a vehicle for happiness. But also, it doesn't always go the way you want it to go, and that's pretty cool, I think, because it gives you a chance to do a do-over and to bring that satisfaction and enjoyment in there.
Two-part question: describe empowerment, number one, and then number two. Is it more difficult to empower employees or athletes or the same?
Okay. Empowerment allows people to take ownership, to have their voice. Okay. To have a voice that they were part of the team, part of the process. Okay. I believe whether it's an athlete or a corporate employee, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I met today for the first time this morning with a bunch of supervisors and managers, and they don't know me. So they're not sure. They don't know me yet. So they don't know if they can trust me yet. That's my first thing that I've done there. But the goal of empowering them, that they feel that they matter within the organization, is really, really important. Okay. And that's another term, mattering. Do you matter? And then when you matter, how well as coaches do we help you with your mattering, and do we know what you're in care for in your scope of contribution on the field as a player? Some people's scope of contribution is minimized. Some of it is maximized. I think one of the top college coaches in New England, okay, is Catherine DiLorenzo, who's the women's field hockey coach at Middlebury College. She's won multiple national coaching awards. The team's won national championships. But the thing is, when I interviewed her, it's just like, I was blown away. It's just like talking about mattering. And she's got a couple athletes every year that she'll have that their scope of contribution is sometimes there's not a lot of playing time. Man, they're incredible in practice. And then, and what they bring to the sidelines in the locker room makes a difference in the overall team performance, team culture, and then the team satisfaction and enjoyment. And so I think that's really important for coaches to be aware of that, letting athletes know their scope of contribution. And at the same time, when they communicate with them, having the sense of empathy. What's it like to be, if you're a youth coach, what's it like to be a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old boy or girl playing the game? What's it like to be in high school? What was it like to be a senior when you lost your senior lacrosse season because of COVID? Well, there's what we call a hot-cold empathy gap there. Well, as a coach, I didn't miss my senior year. No, I got it. Everything was fine. Okay. But what was it like to that senior who, and how do you help them to work through that process? And this is the idea of empathy, of cognitive empathy, of being really able to say to yourself, I understand what you're going through. And also, in some cases, emotionally feel what you're going through. And the third part of empathy, which is just as important, is what's called empathic concern. It means I am here for you no matter what, unconditionally. And when that trust is developed, that incredibly empowers athletes.
John, back to matters. So Kyle and I talk quite a bit about these recruiters. Let me start over here. Kyle and I talk about recruiting and the players who go to college really don't know what they're getting into until they're actually on campus. There's nothing that will prepare them for the rigors of college lacrosse and the academic piece and the athletic piece and the commitment you have to make and all that. So as a college coach, do you know the players that understand their role matters, whether they're the best player on the team or the last player on the bench. Is that something that's built within the athlete, or is that something that the great coaches are able to profess and everyone understands every role on the team matters, whether you're the 45th guy or the second guy?
Great coaches and very effective coaches are able to accomplish that. Of course, there's going to be athletes who go to college hoping to get and to be in that first or second midfielder or in top of pack or et cetera. But the bottom line, I mean, the same thing, you go and you got some schools that are, I mean, some Division III schools, you got 6-7 goalies. So their scope of contribution needs to be known. And I talked to some D3 coaches about these, having multiple goalies. And that's kind of, in some cases, set up front. But it's also allowing the opportunity for some athletes to grow and develop to the point where they might get more of a shot at it. But at the college level, there's limited spots to get a lot of playing time. And so I think when coaches that are really healthy and effective coaches are able to communicate that in really cool ways to their athletes, not that their players and athletes wouldn't be aren't disappointed in that different times, but there's a trust that's developed and that the coaches, the players will trust the coaches because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had two kids come back this week that played. They were freshmen this year in college. They played last year on the team. And I saw them and I hugged them and was like, oh, it's great to have my boys back. And they're just like, coach, I wish you were harder on me, both of them. And I was just like, really? That's your first takeaway? That's the first thing you're going to say to me? Like, that seems kind of crazy. They're like, yeah, I just don't think, like, and they looked around and we have a couple kids going to play in college, not many, like I think one or two. And they're like, they're not ready. And I was like, well, that's why you're here. We can help each other through that and we can prepare them better, right? Like, that's kind of what we're here to do. And it's that kind of moment was just kind of like a click for me. I get these, like, I describe them as clicks or flashes where like, oh, a full realization has just happened in my brain. And that it was impactful in that moment because I was kind of just, it almost validates what I was doing because I am kind of seen as the coach that's hard to please, the coach that is kind of pushing guys a little bit more on the squad. And to have them be like, I wish you were more like that was kind of like, oh, all right. I think that's good. And I think I'm glad you're back because now you can kind of communicate that to this team in a way that I can't. Right.
Right. Exactly, Kyle. And it's just that then that if that vulnerability trust is developed, you get a sense over time that they feel comfortable enough they can share that with you.
Yeah.
Pushing partner, and that you get them so you know the athletes well enough so that over time, now so you can actually push some of the athletes harder and others you need to kind of back off a little bit. And it's just because that's truly player-centered coaching. And I think that's critically important.
Yeah.
To get most out of player.
There's this famous Nick Saban quote where he said, average players want to be left alone, good players want to be coached, and great players want to be told the truth, which I thought was very applicable to a couple situations that I've been in this year. And it's kind of something I think about a lot where, the idea of two wolves, right? There's the good wolf and the bad wolf. Which wolf works here, right? Like, yeah. It should be the good wolf a lot of the time, but sometimes it's the bad wolf, right?
And to quote Saban even further, is great players do things that average players don't want to do.
Right, right. How does that apply to your philosophy that you're talking about in this book? Like, how does that duality manifest to you?
Well, I think the more that athletes and players can be empowered and allows them to stretch themselves and gives them that opportunity to kind of step over that line a little more and take risks. So they, if they fail, and we all fail, right? And then when they fail, they don't take it upon themselves as an indication of that I'm a loser, that I suck or anything like that.
Right.
It's just that I want to be able to do that, to take that step forward. Okay. And the coach trusts me in order to do that. Okay. And the coach cares for me. So if I do fail, the coach is there to kind of pick me up again. I think that's important. I had a situation that, and this was many years ago, so I'm dating myself with my gray hair here. Okay. But back when I was coaching, I was coaching at the Culver Academies. Now I coached them from when I moved out to Indiana from 01 to 04. And back then we were a good team there in Indiana. And basically when I kind of demoted myself after 2004 and we brought a new coach in, and the team got really, really good. And they're just a really excellent team now. But back then, I mean, we're playing the state championship back then, and I had a player on the team got a 3-minute penalty for an illegal stick. And it was too short. He was a little guy, but and like I could feel myself like, you just don't do that. And we tried it ourselves. You never have a stick issue. And I saw the deer in the headlights look on his face, and it was coming over to the box. And I looked at him, and his name was John, J-O-N, and he's looking at me, goes, and it's like his eyes said, "I am so sorry, coach." And I looked at him, and I said, "John, okay, sit down. Okay, you got to put your stick over there. You got to get it. You're going to get a new stick, okay, that's 40 inches plus, 40 to 42. And I said, "I want you to grieve about this for 30 seconds. But then I need you back on the field because you're one of my players that I need out there. I need you out there." So basically, I gave him permission to say, "I feel bad for myself as a 17-year-old adolescent who's feeling sorry for himself, that his ego has been depressed. But then I said, I need you back out there to make this stuff happen." And that's what he heard mostly.
Yeah.
And it was powerful for him. And I didn't think about it. It just kind of happened because I couldn't bristle. And I'm going, "What are you thinking? What are you doing? You're killing us." Okay. I wouldn't have helped him at all. Okay. That would have been selfish on my part. Okay. But for him, it allowed for him to get back on the field and help us win the game, which we did.
And you were empowering his teammates if they heard that conversation you had with them,
sure,
as well.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Exactly.
Because
exactly.
The game is full of mistakes. We're going to,
exactly.
It's full of, you're going to mess up all the time. I mean, whether it's not picking up a ground ball, running offside, this, that, and the other thing. And you've got these coaches out there. "You can't be offside. What are you doing?" Instead, well, maybe it's the coach's fault too. Maybe we didn't do a good job preparing the team at practice and when you can and when you can't be offside and so on, rides and clears and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's very interesting. John, you were a great player. You played at the top of your game or the top of your profession. Now, do you find that playing a game makes you a good coach, or are there more challenges if you are a great player to become a coach versus being an average player like Kyle to be a great coach?
The answers are yes and yes. If you take Aaron Quinn, who's the athletic director at Middlebury, he was a phenomenal D3 lacrosse coach for many years. He never played the game, but he learned the game. He had played football. But I think if you know some of the basics about human behavior, so playing the game can really help you and can really help you from a standpoint of being a very, very good coach. Okay. But it's also having that other piece in there, having that other understanding of human behavior and developmentally of where your athletes are, I think is critical. So it's not an either or. I think it's a both and situation that you had there. For me as a lacrosse coach, especially as a goalie, it allowed for me to become a good goal, a really good goalie coach for many years, just because I understood what it took to be in the cage and the aspects of that. And then I also knew the technical components of it to help the athletes with that. And so I think you kind of paired both of those together, and that was really, really helpful for me. But I'm working with several D1 college hockey goalies now, doing mental prep work with them. And I never played. I played street hockey goalie. Okay. But I know enough about the overall goalie mentality so that helps me, even though I didn't play the game per se.
But I think any person that's between the pipes has a pretty good understanding of what it's like to be shot on and always blamed for letting the puck or the ball go past you.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a goalie, it just seems really, you know, you kind of develop that mentality where I really have worked a lot with athletes down the road of working with mentality is that you're in the greatest position of all sport. And people are going to argue that in different sports, even in lacrosse too. But the idea is that what you can bring to that position, you have that inner and outer game, you know, that you have the game where you're going against the shooters in the offense coming down on you, but you have the inner game in your team, but you have an inner game between the shooter and yourself. And that is pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And when you get to the point where you can really embrace that and enjoy that and know that it's a scoring game, you know, that right. your percentages, your hope is that you're going to make two or three crazy good saves in a game or four of those. And then you're going to make the saves you need to make. Occasionally give up a dummy, and then you're doing well. Can I tell a brief story here?
Sure.
Yep.
That happened, and I mentioned in this book when I was in college playing for Boston State. And Boston State is now UMass Boston, but at Boston State back in the 70s, really dating myself, my senior year there, I had a good summer ball campaign. And then we were playing our first game against Bowdoin. And basically, I got in. I was really excited about it and got in there, and I played absolutely awful. I sucked. And we had two backup goalies who really weren't ready for prime time. So the coach couldn't put them in. So I was kind of stuck there. And we lose like 16-4. And it was awful. First game of my senior year. And I'm just saying, oh boy, that's awful. So I had to grieve. I couldn't go to class for the next 2 days, right? Because I'm grieving, dressing in black and stuff like that, because that was part of my identity. And then 2 days later, it was in April, 75, we're playing Middlebury, okay? And so Middlebury, we tried to get out of our campus, driving over to our field. We played in the back of Harvard on Smith Field, which is behind WBZ, okay, up Sodersfield Road. And so we'd have to drive, take our cars and drive over to there every day. Well, we got caught in Red Sox traffic. Was opening day. So Middlebury had played Tufts the day before, and they stayed in Somerville or Methven. Okay. And then they got to the field an hour before us. So we show up there, and we're a bunch of ragtag hippies. You picture me with my hair down to here, part in the middle, headband, peace sign. No, that was us back then. And Middlebury's all kind of coiffed and in really cool uniforms and stuff like that. And their head coach was Rob Pfeiffer then. Looked like he was ex-military, had a high and tight haircut, really big guy. And he's barking out instructions. So we're going out there, and I'm saying, and I had a so-so warm-up. So my back of my head, my mind chatters going, oh, geez. Will I have it today? Will I have it? Well, first two shots of the game go on me, offside stick and a five hole. And they were good shots, but suddenly I'm thinking, and I'm hearing, oh, Jaeger's not, doesn't have it today. Well, it's nobody saying that but me to myself. Okay. And now, so then I remember Roy Heffernan. He had played at Needham High School. He was a freshman beast, big guy, coming down from midfield from Middlebury, came down. I don't know where my defense was, but he came down all alone on me and took a shot. And I guessed, and I went low, and I scooped it up on a bounce shot. The crowd at 10 went nuts, and I was in the zone. Fed it off, two passes down, we scored the goal, we're down 2-1. And that was it. Next 30 shots, the ball's like a beach ball, and we win the game 6-2. But that's the performance piece. The most important part of the game happened in the second period. Pfeiffer called timeout for Middlebury. So he called timeout Middlebury, and we had a bunch of guys on the team there. And one of the guys on the team, Ronnie and Jemmy, played for us. He had a long hair and stuff like that. He shaved half his beard before the game to pump us out. Well, what's that? And sure. And so I tell you about Ronnie because we dutifully ran to our bench, to Gordy Webb, our head coach, and then they dutifully ran to the Middlebury bench. Ronnie runs to their bench. There's something going on with Ronnie. We don't know. Hey, Ronnie, you're going there. He runs to their bench, goes through their huddle, which you never do, right? Jumps on the back of the coach of the other team, in the middle of it, the players are dumbfounded. Coach turns around. Ronnie comes off the back, takes off his helmet, got a half a beard there. He looks up at Coach Pfeiffer. They look at each other. They smile. They begin to tear up, and they embrace. The backstory. When Ronnie heard the voice calling the timeout, the last time he had heard that voice was 5 years before in the jungles of Vietnam, because Pfeiffer was his platoon commander.
Wow.
And he hadn't seen him since they were deployed.
Wow. Boy, oh boy, does that run through my veins. Wow.
That's crazy.
That's a great.
It's the best story on the history of the podcast. Absolutely.
That happened 48 years ago. I remember it as today. I wrote a book for U.S. Lacrosse in the mid-2000s. I interviewed 10 people from that game. Everybody remembered the same thing.
That is unbelievable. Thanks for sharing that, John.
And that was the longest timeout ever. It is still a timeout.
Yeah.
And that was the idea of individual and team and two teams going against each other. And now we are forever solidified with Middlebury and Boston State Lacrosse.
Absolutely. And that's really
a connection.
At the end of the day, we talk about it all the time, but isn't it certainly what it's all about, the relationships you have in life and playing the game, coaching the game? You know, you and I played late 80s, early 90s together, and here we are in 2023. Reconnecting on the New England Lacrosse Journal, Chasing the Goal.
You had to turn around and read it?
I did.
Did you forget?
I went to Springfield College.
Oh, my God.
Coach, when I was the head coach at Brookline High back in the 80s, late 80s, the one thing that I remember the most and what I was so frustrated with was the players didn't have the passion for the game that I did. That was my challenge, and it took me a while to really understand that and overcome it and just accept the fact that some players are there half the time in terms of their mental capacity and their effort and so on, and it's really not much you're going to do to change these players over, and you've got to deal with them differently than the ones that show up 20 minutes before practice, and they're there 30 minutes after practice shooting and getting better, and that was me, but there are other guys who are there for the ride. And I think, to your point, you finally realize they matter.
They do. Yes, they matter. And you invite them. You invite them to the table.
Right.
And once again, lacrosse, for the three of us, has made such a difference in our lives and our passion and our purpose for the game. And that you invite them to become part of this, okay? And that not every young person comes to the table, comes to the field with work ethic, okay? With a variety of other things, family system dynamics, you know, and a whole other things. But when you invite somebody to this, okay, and it's a safe space for them to succeed and to fail, no matter what, that unconditionally, that's that core value that coaches ought to be having, okay, then you give them the greatest opportunity to flourish. You show up, you connect with them, and you help them flourish. And I think that's critically important. And you can never lose sight of that. And we do at times, of course, but not to do that. So it allows for that safe space to happen for that person who's maybe not as strong an athlete, maybe has a minimal scope on the team, maybe has not been in situations in their life and how they grew up to really work that hard, okay? But maybe you as a coach can help them find a way to work better. And so not always expecting athletes to be cookie cutters and not expecting especially high school athletes to actually be adults out there, because they're not.
Yeah.
15 to 18 years old.
Yeah. I think one of the things, I've told this story a couple of times, but, you know, I always hear about players talk about how great their coaches were, and they always think back to like, this coach said this to me and it was a huge moment in my life. Apologies to everyone that's coached me. I didn't have that, right? Like I don't have that touchstone to look back on. And that is the reason I became a coach. My background is I was a college coach for 13 seasons. I was assistant for half of them, head coach for the other half of a D3 team. And now I do this because, and I still coach because I saw an opportunity to give that to a kid that I coach one town away from where I grew up, which is in the sticks in New Hampshire, right? And that's the part of the coaching that is so impactful to me. And one of the things that I came in here, I'm a ball of fire. I'm just like, I hate driving here. I'm like all aggravated, right? And I sit down and then I just kind of tell a couple stories to Jack and our producer, Yaz. And makes me feel a little better, but I know that I'm losing sight of that, right? Like I know that like that's a thing that I need to get back. And like just talking to you right now, I feel so much better about all of this. Because it also relates to what I do for work, right? Like creative people, and I say this because I think a lot of people don't understand, or people that aren't creative or have a job where they need to create things, maybe don't understand this mentality that you do have to feel empowered, you do have to feel supported, and you do have to have a safe place to fail. And I want to say, like, I do have that here, and I really love it, not just the podcast, but at Siemens Media in general. And it's, like, totally changed my life. And that's why, like, I think this is an impactful message to get out to people. Like, that's one of the great things we get to do with this podcast is have different voices on and different perspectives and also celebrate the things that lacrosse somehow brings us all together. Like Jack said, like, somehow we're sitting here in 2023, despite everything that's happened. And we're talking about this and we're just doing it so people will get something better out of their life. And part of that is lacrosse. And part of that is like our, I want to say duty, but our like will to make that happen as people that the lacrosse has impacted our lives. So I just wanted to say that before we
thank left. You.
Then we share our experiences, which are life lessons that we've had, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, right?
Right.
Every situation I've been involved in, whether it's on the business side or the playing side, the coaching side, has not always been the most thrilling experience I've had, but overall it's been a wonderful experience. And I've been able to experience it with my own kids and friends like you, John. I have a question for you. I found that when I became a parent, that I wouldn't say I became a better coach, but I had a very, very better understanding how to deal with the different emotions and talent, skill level, passion of all the players. And I'd look at the players, whether they, you know, I coached my daughter and I coached my son, and I'd look at them and say, before I said anything to any of the players, would I react the same way to my own son or my own daughter? And I reacted much differently in a positive way with, I believe you've got to bring players up before you bring them down. And so many coaches want to bring them down, and it's very difficult to bring them up. But do you find that coaches who are parents become better coaches or just have a better understanding how to work with the coaches and make them feel important and matter?
Bingo. I
should be right. I'll be writing the next book, John.
You don't have to be a parent to be an effective coach, but by being a parent provides you with enough other life experiences and connections that are transferable to coaching in so many different ways that it can give many coaches a leg up.
Patience.
Yeah, patience everything. So many aspects of parenting commit to coaching.
Yeah. What do you say to those coaches who their ego gets in their way? It's their way or the highway, and they don't want to change.
Well, that's usually I don't put myself around coaches who tend to exhibit those things. Most people do not come to my master class in that situation because it's too threatening. And I want to put a plug in a second for a master class, but basically I say to them, what is your level of satisfaction and enjoyment in your coaching? Are you in harmonious passion coaching becomes part of your life, or is it an obsessive passion that gets in the way at times?
Right.
You know,
very good point.
I think that's hard, but there's things where there's a term that's unconsciously incompetent. And I don't like to use that term, and I never say that to anybody, but they don't realize that they don't have this going. It's not working. And so one way to get that working is to tell the truth on yourself and not using self-deception and getting to reflect on that and in talking to somebody that they trust about that and saying, do I have it right on with me? Or can you tell me honestly where you think I am as a coach?
Right.
And I have to be willing to take that information and maybe move with it.
And sometimes it really hurts for them.
Oh yeah, it really hurts. And a lot of coaches won't do that. I mean, just because it's too inflammatory, and it kind of puts a void in there. But it's one way of recovering into a reflection that's going to allow for yourself to even be in a better coach and really enjoy the process. Well, I've talked to a lot of coaches who, in their first, you know, their first 5, sometimes up to 10 years coached a certain way, and then they needed to make a shift in order for them to be viable. And maybe 25, 30 years later, then they see themselves in this mentor role. And they're saying, if I didn't change back then, I probably wouldn't be coaching today. And we're constantly growing, we're constantly morphing. And that takes a lot of system to reflection. Reflection is critically important. It's all about the term Aristotle, I think, or Plato said, a life well lived is one of reflection and saying, what can I do to be better for myself and for others that I care about over time? It's actually very simple.
Obsession. I think we can't go on without talking about parents being obsessed with their players' performance on the field and how carried away they have become, many of them, actually in New Jersey. I don't know if you saw this, John, but there's a baseball organization. Parents that yell at the umpires or get in the umpire's face now have to take a umpire course, 3-step course on how to become an umpire, and then they have to officiate 1 or 2 games, which I think is a great concept. Problem with our game today is we can't get officials to coach, especially the young generation, because the parents are berating the young officials. And what is your message to the parents? And what is your message to the coaches whose parents are very difficult on the sideline?
Very challenging, very challenging. And that parents love their kids, and they also want good things to happen to their children and adolescents out on playing field. To that. And then if their child, they don't believe, is in a safe space, or if they also, if they believe they've done wrong, or they have certain expectations of their children. And once again, this is a reflection piece. And having them look at their own understanding of sport and their own experiences in sport, their own parents, their own parenting. And you can't, it's very hard to legislate that, okay? And so, as you're saying, compounded by not having enough officials in lacrosse out there, and young officials, makes it even harder, too. And I think one thing with coaches in leagues, with coaches, that they have to have policies in place that there's non-negotiables going on, because we necessarily cannot change parental thinking, but we can look at changing parental behavior that is negative. And we learn in 3 different ways. We learn through modeling behavior, okay, watching people do things right. We learn through the dialogue and having to have the discussion by saying, you can't really say that from the stands. And the third is a consequence. Now, in Jersey, that's a huge consequence. And I think those 3 things have to be enacted by different leagues and have a zero tolerance for that.
Yeah, and I think one of the we have this rule consequence is 24-hour rule. If you're upset about something that happened during the game, your kid didn't get enough playing time, this, that, or the other thing, we ask the parents to take 24 hours off, settle down a little bit, and let's have a mature conversation about the situation that you're not happy about.
Right, because that's system one or automatic thinking. Like it's coming out of me right now, I can't control it. So it's coming out right now. And then 24 hours later, there's a little bit of a buffer time. I think that's a great strategy, Jack.
You can put that in your book if you want.
Next one.
John, what would you like to talk about? Really enjoyed reading your book. Yeah. I'm going to read it again. Some great information about coaching, life, your experiences, some great quotations from fabulous coaches who've had a lot of success, not only in the lacrosse world, but in coaching in general. But what would you like to tell our audience about what you do and how you can help?
Well, yeah, one of the things is that, yeah, my website for that is www.thecoachingzonebook.com. Okay. And then also we are holding a masterclass for coaches, youth and high school coaches on Saturday, October 7th at Endicott College. And Sean Cork will be helping to host that up there. And many of Sean is the former PLL Cannons coach, an assistant AD up there. And I've known Sean and from the goalie world for many, many years. And we're going to be holding a day-long program there too. And you get a copy of the book, everything. And so more of that information will be spread throughout New England, you know, over the summer and into September. Hopefully we'll get a sold-out crowd to that. And I think that's a challenging thing. I got to spend a day on this stuff, a six-hour masterclass. Well, that's a lot of time. Well, is it worth it for you to do? And I believe that's one of the most challenging things of me doing master classes with coaches. I've done it with Springfield College coaches. I've done it with Endicott College coaches. I've done it at Xavier High School in Connecticut, their coaches, and a variety of coaches in different schools in Indiana. And the thing is that to say that coaches are so busy caring for their kids and their coaching and other things that they're doing, it's hard to find that time. But this is a real, this program, this masterclass gives you the permission to reflect and gives you a chance to communicate and talk to other coaches in different sports at different levels about what matters most. And that's really raises my motor when I get a chance to work with people and to see coaches grow and reflect in that way.
Well, if it's anything like how I feel after this podcast, that's worth every minute of your time. I really appreciate you coming on, John. And you can check out The Coaching Zone. You can buy it wherever books are sold and consider going to the masterclass.
And if any parents listening, it's a great book for parents as well.
John. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Jack. I really appreciate it. So it was great.
Yeah, thanks so much, John. Great job. Great job and continued success. Hey, one last story before you go. Never forget, when I think of John Yeager, you know what I think about? It was 1989. We were playing Philadelphia Wings in Philadelphia, and they used to dress us in the NBA visiting locker room, small locker room. And I'll forget, people used to say, they go in the shower, and the shower was 10 feet off the ground. By the time the water hit you, it was cold.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But at halftime, our coach walks in, and you wore all that heavy equipment as the goaltender, and you were dehydrated. You probably lost 10 pounds just at halftime. And it's hot as can be in that locker room, and you're sweating, and Ron Frazier walks in smoking a cigarette, and you almost died. He's blowing smoke in your face. It's like you were ready to keel over and die. And there's a matters moment, right? Smoking matters in the locker room, coach.
All right. Well, let's bring that in. Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piattelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. See you next time.